Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before we get into podcast, please hit subscribe. Please share it with your mates as well. Give us some reviews. It just keeps the podcast going. Really appreciate it. Podcast time. I've been wanting to get this guy on for a very long time, so I'm really excited that Mr. Kyle Watson is finally on the podcast. I've known Kyle for quite a while. We've been on the Dirty Bird together. We have played tours together. Well, not tours, shows together. We've been on the same lineups. We catch up whenever we can, and him and his wife Tash, I love seeing them around, and he's just a lovely person and an insane producer. For me, he sits in his own lane, which is something that I feel like is the most perfect situation for any artist. And he just does his own thing, and I really, really respect it. It's amazing. So I'm going to stop blabbering on and let you guys just listen to the conversation. So without further ado, Mr. Kyle Watson.
Mr. Kyle Watson, what's cooking, man?
Mr. Will, I'm all good in you, man. I'm cooking, actually.
To be fair, yeah.
I feel like we're, because we're both in England, we have to talk about the weather.
Yeah, this is all we do, right? Is it weird coming from South Africa where it's like this pretty much every day for a certain time and literally like everyone is freaking out in the UK?
Dude, it's kind of weird. Like everybody in the country just goes crazy, dude. It's like all over the news. Everyone's like tinfoiling up their windows and stuff. It's wild, but like we're lying in bed. I mean, to be fair, it is pretty hot.
Yeah.
But yeah, we are used to this kind of heat. We just like lie in bed with like no blanket on you. You're just like a fish, bro. Just lying there.
Bearing in mind, this episode is being recorded in July and it's actually coming out in September. So if anyone's thinking that we're mad and not in the right country right now, then we're just doing it well in advance. How's life, man?
Yeah, good, dude. Very good. Just got back from the US yesterday. So
nice.
Still working through a little bit of jet lag.
Mm.
But yeah, life is good, man. How's things with you?
Yeah, really good. Really good. Just like I'm touring. I'm just like traveling every weekend rather than being based in like America. So it's quite nice to be in the UK for the whole summer.
Yeah. Are you going to the US mostly, or are you also going to Europe?
Every other week. So it's like 1 week Europe, 1 week America.
That's a lot of traveling.
Yeah, I don't mind it though. I don't mind it. I think you just kind of, well, you know how it is, you just get used to it, which we're lucky that we're traveling a lot. So yeah, it's been good though. It's It's been nice to just like be home and spend time with my family. Really, it's like don't really get it's to important. See them. Yeah, man, don't really get to see them. How's the move to England been?
It's been good, man. It was almost a year ago that we moved over here. I'm definitely glad that we did it for sure. Like just even if for just one reason to be closer to like the States, which is where I like tour the most.
Yeah.
Like you said, you were traveling like backwards and forwards pretty much every other weekend. Mm. Like for me, it hasn't been as bad, but you know, it has been like a lot of traveling. And when I lived in South Africa, it was just a nightmare.
Yeah.
You could either take like a 16-hour long flight like to Atlanta and then connect somewhere, or you could go via somewhere, and like London is like the most obvious option. So yeah, we were just going via London anyway. So what we've done is we've actually just managed to cut out like half the travel time. So it's kind of like it's made it way easier to get or to take shows, like to just do a weekend.
Yeah.
You know, whereas before coming from South Africa, you would always have to do like two weekends to make it worth it. Otherwise it was just like such a mission just for like one weekend. So
and then you gotta stay in hotels for the week, and it's like it's more expensive. Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah, you gotta work out like what city you're staying in, because some cities obviously are like insanely expensive to spend like off days in. And then you may as well just like get a flight back home, and go back out. Yeah,
it's weird, isn't it? What, like, because the expenses of being a DJ, although we're lucky enough that we can earn good money, but even like starting out now as an artist must be tough.
100%, dude. Like, it's actually kind of crazy when you look at everything, like from the top down, and you see like the. You'll get like the offers for the shows or whatever, and it's X. And then, you know, for me, like also, and maybe for you, I guess, like withholding tax, you know, like, cause I'm not like a citizen of the country. So I get taxed like at a very high rate. So you've got to like smash that off straight away.
30%. You've got to
like all of the fees, you know, like, the commissions and stuff, plus then obviously the money that it takes to get there, to stay over, to travel like locally and everything. So, it's kind of crazy like how much gets chipped away out of that.
And also then you've got the cost of everything that's gone up massively. And
flights, it's mad now.
Flights are ridiculous.
Flights are crazy now, man. It's like so you have to really like allocate so much more of the budget. Like the fee to that. It's actually wild right now,
but then fees aren't really going up.
No, not really. not to match the everyone put all of their charges up, except and the DJ fees didn't go up.
Yeah, just stayed the same. We have it good though. We have it pretty good. Like
we do. It's like I always say to everyone that it does beat, like for me at least, like sitting in the same place, you know, 5 days a week. Going to the same place, like doing the same thing, like it's always different, you know, like this career, this industry, it's always different. There's always different people to meet. It's always, you know, different places to play, things to see, food to eat. Like it's just, you know, it's really lucky that we get to actually do this.
Because you worked for a long time still, didn't you, whilst touring? Like one of the only people that I know that like carried on working, which I really respect. And I think there's, what was the reason behind that, or like why, I guess?
So, you know, financial stability was just nice to have like that, you know, monthly
income,
guaranteed income coming in. And also like what I was talking about earlier, you know, the fact that we were living in South Africa and I wasn't like coming in and out for, you know, the opportunities where you could just, you know, come in for a show or two shows and go back home. I wasn't doing that, right? So we were always organizing trips that were a bit longer and more spaced out. So like from a cash flow perspective, it was a little tricky, you know, it would have been a little tricky to just rely on only touring income, you know, like life would have changed a lot. And also like, secondly, I have always said, like when I get asked that question, that like in this industry, 100% you need to have like a plan B. And the biggest like example of that was COVID. You know, like I actually built a career around video editing and motion design and stuff before actually, you know, building a career in music.
Yeah.
So I had like all those years of experience to, you know, in the industry to make money while the world was closed down. You know, like in South Africa, everything shut down. I mean, like the clubs closed. A lot of them didn't reopen. So like the industry's taking a big knock, but the clubs closed. The US closed. My visa ran out like right when COVID hit. So I couldn't get another like O-1 to come to the, to the US until they opened their embassies, which like, I mean, I couldn't even go overseas to make money. I ended up actually only being able to get a visa when I came over to London. Like I had to move over here and actually go to the embassy here to get it. But yeah, that was why I always kind of kept that going. The only time that I've kind of like really been doing music 100% full time is actually since landing here.
How does that feel?
In fact, probably like the last year.
How does that feel?
Dude, somehow, I don't even know how, man, but I feel more busy than I was when I had a job. I don't know why, dude. If it's the admin or something. I mean, I love the fact that I have the time to like work more on music and play around with different ideas and different styles and stuff. You know, whereas I didn't really necessarily have that much time to do that, you know, like when I had the job, it was almost like, I mean, it got really, really hard, you know, over some periods, especially when things got busy, you know, you were working on music or you're working like a job from like 9:30 to, I think I was working from 9:30 to 3:30 or whatever. And then like jumping onto music after that, cooking dinner, you know, spending enough time, you know, at home and everything like that. So it did become a lot to balance.
I think you just get used to it though, right? It's like a routine that you just kind of get used to doing. I remember when I was, before I went full time in music, it was working full time and then working at night in the studio, and you just like do what you had to do to make it work.
You got to be careful though, because like it can become just the only thing that you do, which is like, you know, you don't spend enough time with the people around you and everything. So,
100%.
Got to be a balance.
Yeah. Well, I think for me though, I don't know about you, but I still feel like at the beginning of my career, like most people have to just lock themselves away for a couple of years just to kind of work out how to get where they need to get to. And then once you kind of done that, like, I don't know about you now, but it's weird that writing music doesn't necessarily always take a priority in my life now, where it used to all the time. Other things kind of seem to take priority, and then admin kind of takes over and just get caught up doing all the little shit. And then you're like, oh fuck, I actually need to write music. Do you get the same?
Yeah, I think it's very easy. I was actually thinking about this morning, before we started the call, about like the pressure that artists, and I know we've spoken about it as well, but like the pressure that artists put on themselves. And I think like there is another balance there that needs to be struck, because it's kind of easy once you've been in the industry for a while. It's almost like there's like this arc, right? Like you put the time in the beginning to kind of figure out where you want to go, and you know, and you kind of get there, and then when you get to where you want to go or you want it to be, you start putting even more pressure on yourself, because like you have this fear of, you know, this fear of losing relevancy or, you know, something, you know, there's always speed bumps, right? And like, I think it's like easy to overthink that kind of stuff. So it's difficult. You mustn't like fall into that trap as an artist of worrying, because, you know, then it does start to feel like more of a job and less of a passion. Like the reason why you got into it was because you loved writing music. And then the more you kind of worry about the career side of things, the less time you end up putting in to the craft that, you know, was actually the reason why you started.
Yeah. And I think that's when your music can become like very formulaic, and it's like, you just go into the studio, do the same thing over and over again. You don't try new shit. Like it happens to me, and I don't know if it's happened to you, but like, I remember about a month ago, I was talking to a mate that's like just like buying new gear and kind of like just experimenting. And I'm like, damn, I miss those days. I miss just like going into the studio. And I know people do this that are successful artists anyway. It's just for me, like, I just don't necessarily go into the studio now and experiment and just like not come out with anything. It's for me, it's like, because studio time is so sparse, like, I have to come up with the goods to.
Yeah.
Because like with traveling, with everything else as well, it just seems to be like the studio time is not happening as much. Do you get the same?
Yeah. I mean, I do, dude. I think, like, especially because of, like, me personally, because of, like, what my life has been over the last sort of, like, year and a half, it's been insane. You know, like, so busy and stressful and moving house multiple times.
How many times?
Four times we literally moved in a year. Well, like, three. We lived in four different houses. We moved three times. It's like, or twice. It was crazy. But yeah, because of all of that, it was like, I did get that feeling where it was like, okay, well, I'm going to sit down in the studio and actually just, like, you know, write. And something good has to come out, you know. I have to have this finished product at the end. And it's kind of interesting now that you say that. It makes me think about, like, my music that I wrote in lockdown versus my music that I've been writing out of lockdown. There's definitely a difference that I can see from, like, an artist's perspective, in the sense that, like, there was no pressure during lockdown, and then there was more pressure once everything opened up. So it's actually kind of interesting. I had a bit of an epiphany now. But yeah, I mean,
what's the difference? What are the differences?
I don't know. I feel like maybe I was taking more risks. In lockdown, I was taking it less seriously, and I was just like, kind of like, anything goes. And I think it's important to really keep that.
It's strange, isn't it? Because I think for me during lockdown, I was writing records that I knew weren't really club records. I was releasing records that weren't really club records, and I think
most people were doing that.
Yeah,
so they felt that pressure lifted.
And I think it's weird because I've had a conversation with Ryan yesterday, and I've been asked to do a remix. By the time if it does come out, it will be out. So I was asked to do an Elenium remix, which is like dubstep, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be out or not. So if it's out, it's out. If it's not, then you're never going to hear it, people. So I apologize. But it was like, we didn't have an argument at all. I don't disagree with what he was saying, but he was like, the remix I did was pretty much a straight up, like, pop record. Like, I remade a dubstep record, a pop dubstep record, into a pop house record.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, more accessible record.
Yeah.
And he was like, the thing is, mate, it's just not, doesn't sound like Will Clark. And I battle with this on a regular, because I'm like, I know as an artist, you need a sound, right? So to people to pin it onto you.
Yeah.
But then there also comes a point where it's like, how do you kind of, like, take risks?
Yeah.
As an artist, and how, like, I don't think. Yeah. What's your thoughts on that?
It's so interesting, actually, that you say that. I agree with you. Like, you do need to create it, and you have created a like, you know, I'm not saying you, but artists have spent the time creating, you know, the music that people expect.
Yeah.
You know, the type of music that people expect to hear. So it's a very fine line that you have to walk. That's kind of between, like, you know, ticking the boxes that you've been ticking for years or months or decades or whatever, but, you know, going too far and, you know, totally, you know, confusing people. There's a very thin line. I think a lot of it comes down to, like, production style, you know, and the choices that, as a producer, you're not necessarily that aware of, but that people just kind of, like, attach to your music. I think it's important to, like, keep those elements running through whatever you produce. So, like, I've taken those risks before, you know. I really enjoy, you know, drum and bass and electronica and flume and stuff like that. And, like, I said as a producer, and I'm like, it's a bit of a waste, because, like, not necessarily a waste, but a missed opportunity that I'm not writing stuff like this, because, like, you know, I can't, like, I know that I can.
Yeah.
And so, like, tracks like Fever that I did that remix for Tatum, which was like a, I don't know what it was. It was like a halftime 130 or something BPM.
Yeah.
I just put it out. I did a remix for Goldfish like 5 years ago or something, and it was like slow house, like 110 house or 105 house. I just put them out, dude. You know, I think you just got to do it. As an artist, it's like you don't want to feel kind of like you're trapped within the bounds of what people expect from you. I think it's really important to grow out of that. And it's interesting that we head this direction, because lately, over the last like few months, I've been working on a project, sketches for a new album, and I don't really want it to be like only house music. Like, I obviously want there to be really good house records on there, and I want there to be like, you know, examples of growth within like the genre and stuff for me. But I also want there to be tracks on there that are not house, but that are still Kyle Watson, you know? And it's kind of weird, because you were asking about like, how do you still make it like a Kyle Watson record if it's not a, it's like not a Kyle Watson record, you know, like it's not a house record. Like if someone just heard one track or two tracks of mine, you know, two successful house records, and then heard something from the album that wasn't, I mean, it would probably be like,
what's this?
You know, confusing, but I want them to be, I'm confused, but that's fucking sick, you know?
Exactly. And this is the thing, is like, I think that's the thing, is if people are questioning, I think at the end of the day, is it a good record? So first of all, is it a good record? Yes. Secondly, does it sound like Kyle Watson? Maybe not. Does it sound like Will Clark? Maybe not. But it's still a good record.
Uh-huh.
So why does it?
It has to be good.
It has to be good. And I think this is the thing, is like, some of my favorite records of artists aren't what they sound like, but it is what they sound like because they made it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I think it's just the confidence of the artist to just go, fuck it, here it is. And this 100%. Is what I've done. Like, I'm not just a one trick pony. Like, that's why I stopped writing music for Dirty Bird, because I was just like put in this box of like, we'll only make booty records, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And
100%.
And it's not like, but I think this is the thing with maybe the like, house, the electronic music industry, maybe, is that you just kind of have to, maybe the whole industry, I don't know, maybe you just have to be put in a box. We all have that when we were kids, like we had like our favorite artists, and then they made like a album that sounded nothing like them, and we're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Oh, they've changed.
Yeah, they're not as good as they used to be.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah, it's just inherent, like it's gonna be there, that is gonna be there forever. But 100%, I think it does come down a lot to the confidence of the artist, you know, and like the confidence they have in producing these other genres, which, you know, they can still make it sound like it's comes from you, you know? I think the opportunities shouldn't really, I mean, to be fair, it also depends where you are, I think, in your career.
Yeah.
I think in the earlier days, while you're trying to build up like a following, and you have a clear idea of where you want to be, like, I think then, you know, switching genres and stuff like that can be very confusing while you're trying to like build a fan base or like your foundational fan base. But I think once you've built that foundational fan base, you have a big enough like market for people to really kind of enjoy whatever you put out and appreciate it, then I think it's kind of like safe to do that. I think like maybe advice to producers who are just starting out and want to you know, vary their genres, it might be like a good idea to do something under an alias, you know, while you grow and stuff. And then, you know, there's a chance to like kind of cross over when the time is right.
When you first started out, did you look at labels and be like, I need to write records that fit on these labels?
Mm. I still think that sometimes.
Yeah.
I think it's down to that. It's down to that pressure that we were talking about earlier.
Mm.
But 100%, I think personally, I think it's actually kind of good to have those goals. Like, I have a Patreon page, and I talk a lot about like, you know, about how new artists should like approach getting signed and stuff like that. And like, I kind of have like this pyramid thing where like at the top of the pyramid, it's like your three or whatever, like end goal labels, you know, Defected or, you know, like really big labels, Tool Room and stuff like that. And then like your second option, your third option, and I think it's good to have those goals. And, you know, just because of the nature of art and stuff, you know, they do expect like a certain type of record. Like, so if you are going to aim for, I mean, I'm just using Defected as an example, then you're going to need to write a Defected record.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're not going to just sign any old record. Yeah, so yeah. I do think that you do need to have that, but at the same time, you have to be aware, you know, that that other things, you know, other tracks can come out from, you know, this journey to writing this record for Defected. You might start something and write something totally different, which is fucking amazing. Mm. And it might fit on a totally different label. So it's important to just keep like the awareness of what you're writing.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's how I started for me, is realizing, oh, damn, I need to be... I think it's changed a lot, actually, though, now. Maybe it hasn't. Maybe I'm just kind of... because I don't write for labels at all now. But maybe it's like... I'm just thinking the way music gets released nowadays, you can have a record that doesn't necessarily have to be on a big label to be successful and kind of get you in different places. I think it's more so the association you're kind of paying for when you're releasing records, right, on bigger labels.
Like the clout.
Yeah, or the gigs. Because realistically, we know that none of us really make money on music unless you're making pop records. So
yeah.
I think the only way for us to really make money on a regular basis is to do shows.
Touring, yeah. 100%. It's like 85% or 90% of my income.
Yeah.
Like my music income, if you add it all up, it's like such a small amount is from music, royalties and publishing and stuff like that. And it's so sparse. It's like, you know, you'll put out 5 records in a year or something, or 6 records in a year. Maybe one of them will give you like a nice paycheck in a year and a half.
Yeah.
You know, so you really can't rely on it either. Touring is pretty much the only way. But yeah, I think it does help in the sense that, you know, if you're strategic about it, and I speak with my agent about this quite often, if you're strategic about the labels that you put your records out on, there are opportunities that open up, you know, for events like labels that throw events, especially successful ones, you know, that have like built-in followings. They're very valuable for artists because it puts you in front of a whole bunch of people that maybe otherwise wouldn't have seen your name.
Totally.
So it is very valuable if you think about it like that. It just depends kind of like on how strategic you want to be about building your brand, like as an artist.
Yeah. Where do you sit with that? Because I feel like you sit in your own lane.
You'd be surprised, dude. I have my goals, target labels, just like everyone else.
Interesting.
I mean, I do. Honestly, it's like a 50-50 for me. I do want to sometimes sit down in the studio and just write like whatever. I want to make a track today. Let's see what happens, whether it's house or not. Like, I do that. But at the same time, I also do sit down and go, like, this label is kind of like where I want to be right now, you know, where I want to be considered, and I do aim for some of those. So yeah, I'm on both sides.
So where do you want to be right now?
Look, I think it would be cool to work with Black Book. We're discussing at the moment, like Chris and I, well, I've known Chris for, I say I've known him, but for a long time. He actually signed one of my EPs in like 2011 or something on his label he used to own back then called Rising. And I mean, it would be great to get a record on Black Book. We are working on something at the moment. It's lots of paperwork and red tape and stuff. I won't say too much about it, but it's a track people have been asking about for a while. So we're really trying so hard to get it like nailed in. So hopefully we'll have good news about that soon. And it's good. I mean, I think like no matter what level you're on, like you need to have these goals and things that, you know, once you hit them, you tick them off. I think it's important, dude, because it drives you and it helps give you confidence as well, especially when you're ticking the boxes.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I think goals are the most for me anyway, and maybe not for other people, but for me, the most important thing to kind of measure your success to a certain extent, because I think it's very easy to just look at a financial side of things on how to measure how successful you are. But realistically, like, it goes back to what you were saying, is we started out with a passion of writing music, and that doesn't necessarily mean you have to make a load of money. Like, there's other things that can make you successful, and whether that's signing to your favorite record label or doing whatever, like, there's lots of ways to see that. How do you measure success?
I think it's really just different for everyone. I think it's how you feel. I mean, do you feel like you're successful when you go out, and do you play these shows, and do you feel like fulfilled by playing the shows? Do you feel like the music you write and you can be proud of?
Yeah.
I mean, like, going back to what you were saying earlier, like, you don't, to a degree, like, you know, because of this industry, because of what it is, right? People are going to measure you. And I'm saying people, but, like, you know, maybe not your fans, but maybe, like, you know, promoters or potential, like, business opportunities and stuff. Yeah. They're going to measure you by, like, your past achievements. So, you know, signing to, like, an important label or playing an important stage at a festival and stuff, like, even if as an individual you don't really place that much importance on that, like, there is going to be importance placed on it. Just because of, like, the business focused nature of this industry, like, and especially in the US, it's very, like, business focused and achievement focused. So, like, if you've played at this X festival, then this promoter will pay attention to you, or if you've released on this label, then this promoter might book you or something. So, like, it is, those types of things are important, as much as, like, maybe, because every artist is different. Like, some people are quite happy to just make music and fuck it. Like, if it blows up, it blows up. If it doesn't, whatever. Like,
dude, I love those people, but I can't.
100%, dude. Like, that is what I was when I started out. Like, I didn't have a goal. I had zero goal to, like, get to a certain, you know, stage of, you know, where I am touring or whatever. I didn't even know I wanted to become a DJ.
Really?
Like, I didn't even really have an epiphany where everyone talks about, like, was at this rave and I saw fucking Tiesto and I was like, damn, I want to be that guy. You know, like, I didn't have that moment at all, dude. I was just making beats and I was like fucking having fun.
That's amazing. I love that.
And this is, dude, I'm talking about, like, what is it? I mean, I'm talking about, like, 2005, 2006, 2007 before I met my wife. Like, I was just fucking
loving,
I was just having fun, man.
Yeah.
And it just kind of grew.
So when you met Tash, it wasn't fun from down on. It was just like,
it became business.
She's make money, but
no. So when I met Tash, her brother James was in the industry, so he actually got me my first signing.
Oh wow.
I don't even know, like, if we hadn't met, I don't really know if I would have carried on. Like, I don't even know what would have happened with music, really, dude, because I didn't have, like, the targets.
Yeah.
It all just was very organic.
What did you want to do when you were younger then? Was there anything that you were like, I really want to be this person?
I wanted to become, like, a mechanical engineer. I don't even know why, but I think it was maybe because one of my older half brothers was one, but when I got to college and I was more aware of, like, what I was good at and what I wanted to do, like, it was definitely art. It was, like, some kind of an art, you know. I always enjoyed, like, video editing and stuff like that, and I think that's, like, the crossover between the two is kind of, like, actually obvious when you think about it, like, the way it's made and the way the stories are told and stuff. They're very similar like, skills. So I actually kind of, like, started on that before making music. When I got to college, I realized, like, okay, well, maybe I want to be, like, a video editor or something like that.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Patreon for a bit.
Of course.
First of all, people that don't know what Patreon is, what is it?
Patreon's a website where you can pay, like, a monthly fee and you get access to certain things. So it's fucking wild, dude. I set this up in April 2020 when the touring fell away. People had been asking for years, like, mentor me or you know, give me advice on this track and what do you think of this record and stuff. And like, I just never had the time to give people proper advice and all of that. So I kind of always just kind of, I didn't ever take it any further. But then obviously when I had a bunch more time, I was like, well, let's just fucking do it. So I started it up, in April 2020. It's been going for like two and a bit years.
You started pretty quick.
Hey?
You started quick out of lockdown. Mm. Lockdown was like starting mid-March.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning of March or the end of Feb, I think that was my last show.
Yeah. I think we were hanging out.
What was that?
In Arizona.
When was that?
Was
that in 2020?
I don't know.
I think that may have been before, dude.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah. Because the last tour that I did was in Oz.
Oz, yeah. Yeah, it was before.
So
yeah.
I did the shows in Oz and we were traveling through like the, UAE? Can't remember exactly. But we were traveling through airports, people were wearing masks. We're like, what's going on? Anyway, that's a different story for a different day. Everything went to shit. And I was like, let's just do this. So basically every month there's at least one video, whether that's like a track breakdown or a studio session or a tutorial or something like that. There's always a video that I create. Right now it is like, I don't even know how many videos there are out there, 30, 33, 34, 35. Yeah. There's like a Discord community and if you pay a little more, you get track sessions. So like what we're doing now, you would get like a video session where I would feedback on like one of your records, give you advice and stuff like that.
How have you found it? It's a super cool concept. I think we live in a world where, I don't know about you, but like, I have a weird concept of asking people for money, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it is kind of weird.
Yeah, it's kind of like, why is that weird? Why is it weird to ask people for money when you're given a service? It's like everyone goes and gets their hair cut. Everyone goes and gets whatever. They pay for a gym. They pay tickets to see you.
Nothing's for free. I think you have to give yourself value as an artist, right? Like you've literally put decades of your life into this craft.
Yeah,
like why would you give that away for free?
Yeah,
you know, I think at the very least you do like, you know, $5 a month, $10 a month from someone who wants to learn from you.
Yeah,
I think you also underestimate like how many people actually do want to share in that knowledge that you have. It is weird. It's a weird concept to ask for money, but it's not like you're just asking for it for donation, right?
Yeah.
You're actually
giving them a service. Like
for me, I've literally been spending since 2004, 2005, building up the skill set. Like, you know, why would I give that knowledge out for free?
Yeah.
You know, I think you have to place a value on yourself.
No, I totally agree.
It's just like a carpenter, dude. Like a carpenter didn't go to fucking whatever woodworking school and practice carpentry for like 40 years to just like literally
do it for free.
Like, so you're gonna pay if you want your kitchen done, bro.
It's so weird, isn't it though, because we do work in an industry where like people like to not pay you.
Yeah,
it's like
people want stuff for free or cheap, dude. That's just human nature.
Yeah, it's like the awareness gigs where you're like,
oh yeah, this will be good for awareness. We'll pay you in all of the awarenesses.
Yeah, I've got the same glasses as you. Nice glasses, mate.
Oh yeah, dude. Premium.
Classic.
Absolutely premium. I cooked a frozen iced coffee in here earlier.
You cooked a frozen iced coffee.
Cooked an iced coffee, bro.
Please tell me how this makes sense.
No, it wasn't cooked at all, dude. It was brewed.
Okay.
It was brewed at like seven. So I don't wake up early, bro. I just don't.
Did I make you wake up early?
No, okay. No. Jet lag made me wake up early.
Okay.
It was terrible, dude. I woke up before six, which is not like me, bro. I don't do that.
Yeah, that's pretty early.
Yeah, it's early, dude. Early. I mean, like, to be fair, it's the side that people of touring that people don't see.
Yeah.
Coming off the back of like a weekend where you have like three shows or two shows. It's ridiculous, dude. You just can't get a normal sleep, no matter like how, you know, how crazy you are or how normal you are as a person. It's like, you just don't get a normal sleep pattern. It's impossible.
It gets you occasionally, doesn't it? It's just like, bam. So I'm generally okay. It doesn't get me too bad, but then you're like one day you'll be like, oh fuck, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah. Or you're left to let me just have a quick nap before the show and then wake up and you're like, dude.
Yeah.
There were just like pouring eye drops into your eyes, dude.
Napping kills me every time.
But it's like, I don't know, dude. Some people, like, I know we've spoken about this. Some people can't nap. Like, I have to nap, dude.
Do you?
I have to have a nap. Yeah.
I can't. I will, but not on purpose. Like, I like fall asleep watching something.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I just try and soldier through, which means that when I do sleep, I sleep like a mother, like just pass out for like a few hours.
Yeah.
Do you drink a lot of coffee?
I do drink a lot of coffee. I drink three coffees a day.
That's not bad.
It's not bad, dude. I know like people drink a lot more, but I mean, you know, coffee's not that good for you. If I don't have a coffee like in the morning, I definitely feel weird.
Really?
Like, I definitely feel a bit like crankier, a little bit slower.
Yeah,
you know, like my head feels a little bit full. 100% like I'm somewhat addicted to caffeine.
It's mad, isn't it? Because caffeine is just caffeine's a drug, and it's so weird that like other drugs aren't legal, but caffeine is probably.
Please don't get coffee like banned, bro.
Exactly.
I need it.
Well, I don't drink coffee, but I wish I liked it. I don't like it. I'm a child. Don't like the taste.
It's probably better that you don't like it, though, dude. Probably. It's probably better.
But I have this obsession with coffee machines. And I really want a coffee machine, but I'm never going to use it. Because I love the like the mechanics of them and how they look. And they're like beautiful pieces of furniture, and
they're awesome, dude. Yeah. Especially those big ones.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah,
I really want. Do you have one? Do you have a bougie one?
No.
Are you straight instant coffee boy?
No. I call that plastic coffee, dude. I don't drink plastic coffee. That's only desperate, dude. Like when we moved countries, I had to pack up my coffee machine and we shipped it like months before, and I drank plastic coffee for
a while. Did it give you extra jitters? Do you like start getting a twitch or something?
Oh yeah, just it wasn't scratching the itch, dude. And yeah, dude, that first coffee once the machine arrived, dude, so good.
Was it amazing?
It was so good. Well, it's not a bougie coffee machine though, dude. It's just literally a little Nespresso with the pods, bro. It's not like super fancy.
Nespresso is kind of looks kind of cool though.
Looks good, dude. Nah, yeah. It's fancy looking.
I feel like it's like the high end of the low end, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll go with that, bro.
Yeah. I'll take that, dude. My parents have an Nespresso machine.
Yeah, it keeps me alive, and that's fine.
I like the Nespresso shops as well.
I do. You do feel like you're very special when you go to a Nespresso shop.
I know, right?
It's
like going to the Apple shop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although I feel that Apple shop's kind of got a bit common now. It's got a lot of commoners in there.
Out of the peasants at Apple, bro. I don't know at the Apple shop that's near us, we've got a mall, and there's an Apple store in there, and they have like a bouncer.
Yeah,
I don't know how it works, dude, but he's there. He's got like an iPad. I don't know if you have to like pre-book to go and buy a fucking iPhone or something. I don't know, dude, but there's a dude out there like checking people off as they go in.
Oh really? Oh yeah, you don't have an iPhone. You're not on Apple, are you?
I'm an Android.
Motherfucker, you'll change one day, mate. Are you on Apple laptop computer?
Dude, everything else for me is Apple. It's weird. I mean, I just I've always written on Apple for like the last like 12 years or whatever. I have a laptop, Apple. So I mean, yeah, everything else is Apple. Like Tash, dude, she said to me so many times, she's like, literally, why do you have an Android when everything else you have is Apple? Like, it would be so easy.
Yeah,
you can like, I can't use AirDrop. You know, but it's the life I chose, man.
just like to be difficult for that one. But do you like have being on Android? Like why?
I like it, dude.
Have you tried an iPhone?
I mean, I haven't lived with an iPhone, but I mean, I've used Tasha's. She's been using it. She's had them for years. But like, I don't know, man. I just feel like Apple is like iPhone just kind of like directs you where you need to go. Like Android, you can make your own decisions. Like that's what it feels like, bro.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. It's a closed system, isn't it? So
it is. But I mean, I'm quite a simple guy. So if I just one day was like, well, fuck it, let me just get an iPhone, I would just live with an iPhone. Like, it would be fine.
I'm just,
you know, like I just use this to write messages anyway, bro.
If I get rich somehow, I'm just going to buy you an iPhone and just be like, sorry, mate, you got to get an iPhone now. You're on iPhone.
Just you're going to call this video up and be like, you said you would.
Yeah, bro. Literally, just for the blue messages. The thing I love about iPhone is the integration between all the products. So it's like, everything is just linked between all of them. So you kind of never really lose anything. It's very easy. It's very just like, it's just there. If I want to pull up a photo from like 5 years ago, it's there.
Yeah. It's on my phone too.
Yeah, but it's just not on your laptop at the same time. Or it's not in the cloud. Or if you lose that phone, it's not there.
No. You mean, well, yeah, it can be. It can be.
You're just defending it and you know you're going to lose.
Yeah, just don't make this personal, bro.
Oh, dear. When you've just announced a tour.
Yes. So by the time this goes out, I would have announced the tour.
Yeah.
What's on My it? Machines. Yeah. It's cool, dude. It's the biggest, tour that I've done so far.
Sick.
When I say the biggest, it's not the longest or like the most dates, but it is like, you know, conceptually the biggest. So basically, this was meant to happen in 2020. Mm. We were literally working on it. We were like halfway through it when everything closed down. It was going to be in October 2020.
Yeah.
We did the first like tester of the event. In fact, I did the first one of these in South Africa when I lived there at my home club in Joburg called Truth. Mm-hmm. My Machines. It's a set which is only my music, you know, specially curated. It's got like, it's got records that people know, but it's also got records that people don't. It's got like brand new stuff that hasn't come out. It's got edits that never came out, VIPs. It's all Carl Watson, right? Whether it's a remix or an original or an edit, whatever, it's mine. And it's more of a journey. Mm. So it kind of starts somewhere and it ends somewhere else.
Yeah.
Especially curated. It's going to have, the first one was in South Africa in, I don't know, 5 years ago, 4 years ago. Mm. The first one in the US was in LA.
Sound,
New Year's
wasn't
Eve. It? Sound, yeah, New Year's Eve, that. 2019, 2020. Mm. And it was really good, dude. It was awesome. funny story about that before I go on that night. The support DJ had the same flash drives as me. And so I don't know how it happened, dude, but somewhere along the line, I put in only one of my flash drives and I linked four CDJs to one flash drive.
Yeah.
And I thought that I'd put two in and linked the two. Anyway, turns out I hadn't done that, right? So road trips, dude, out of all the records, emergency loop, bang, goes into emergency loop. And I'm like, I'm like, fuck, okay, quickly. So I try and switch over the flash drive and I'm going through like this other flash drive and I'm like, bro, this is not my music. I don't know what any of this is. And I'm like, dude, I'm panicking. Luckily, Tash was there. She had like one of my other flash drives. She fucking like threw it over to me, quickly plugged it in, got out of the emergency loop after like 40 seconds. But so stressful, dude. After that, I painted numbers on my flash drives.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, that's not going to happen again.
I had that the other day where, because I don't use a flash drive, I use a hard drive and it's just a cable.
Yeah.
And the DJ before me had exactly the same. I've never seen anyone use it exactly the same. I didn't mix in, so I just played my intro record.
Mm.
And like, I was like, oh, there's a really long gap between these vocals. Like, there wasn't a gap between this long before. And then I realized that the other DJ just pulled mine out instead of theirs.
Oh. At least he was still there. My support DJ went off. So it was New Year's Eve, bro. He went off to another rave. So we had to like communicate to get, because he took my flashlight.
Oh, he took yours.
He took mine, but he thought it was his.
Oh.
Anyway, yeah, I'm sure that everyone has stories like
so
that.
So good. It's funny when it happens afterwards.
It's nice. Yeah, it's not funny when it happens. It's fucking terrible when it happens. It's amazing afterwards. It's a great story afterwards. You should definitely paint like something on your hard drive, dude. But yeah, back to the tour. Yeah, My Machine. So we had the first one in South Africa, second one in Sound, and now we're doing like a run. The rooms are some of the biggest that we've hard ticketed.
Amazing.
Which is like, you know, it's stressful as an artist, but I think, you know, we've got some really cool support on it.
Talk me through it. I want to know.
Yeah. Okay. So it's in September, October. It's, I think there's probably 10, 11 or 12 dates.
Nice.
Some of them are smaller, but some of them are going to be bigger. So we're doing shows like at the Midway, we're doing Summit at Denver.
Sick.
We're doing some smaller shows like Monkey Loft in Seattle, which will be cool. I don't think I can announce one of the biggest ones yet. So I'd rather not. I'll just play it safe. But yeah, it's going to be really cool. We're doing Sunbar in Tempe. It's going to be really cool, dude. So sets of 2 hours to 2.5 hours.
Nice.
All my own music, Journey, custom like visual loops, curated supports, special guests. It's going to be awesome.
Have you got support on there as well?
Yeah, I do have support. So we have a special guest, Chapter and Verse, which is really cool. I'm very happy to have him on there.
I don't know who that is. Who's that?
Chapter and Verse.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing really well, dude. House artist. He's been blowing up recently.
I need to check his music out.
Yeah, you must check it out, dude. It's very cool stuff. We've got Domi. We've got The Sponges. Nice. Miss Dre.
I love Miss Dre. She's
Kyle Kinch. Yeah. It's going to be cool, dude. It's going to be really cool.
Nice, man. Nice.
Yeah. The biggest tour, or like the first tour of this kind that I'm doing. So like I said, stressful, but exciting.
What's the stress behind it?
I mean, you're putting yourself out there, dude, especially when you're doing big rooms that are hard ticketed. Like you've got to sell those tickets. They got to move. That's the stress, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there's other little mini stresses along the way, like making sure the announce goes well and, you know, like making sure all that stuff and securing PR and all of that kind of stuff. Those are little speed bumps. But the main thing is just filling the rooms. I think as any artist like would tell you, that's that is like probably the biggest stress.
It's tough, isn't it? Because it's like the rooms are big. Like 1,000 people is, even with 500 people, is a lot of people to try.
I mean, it's a lot of tickets to sell. Dude.
It really is. And it's weird that... We're all lucky enough that we do this on a regular, and it's like that constant want for more. So like each year it's like, okay, well, we did 500 tickets here. Now we need to do 1,000 tickets, and now we need to do 2,000 tickets, and blah, blah, blah. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
What do you think that's about?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I mean, growth, dude, that is just what it is. Mm. I mean, I think you have to always want like something a little bit more.
Yeah.
For me, at least. I think like wanting a little bit more is always going to be one of the like fundamental drivers between, you know, your passion and your art and stuff. Yeah. I think anybody who wants to take this career seriously, like it's not really, I mean, the goal is not to work up to a 350 cap room or 500 cap room and then just stay there.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to also be realistic. There's arcs in this industry and people come up and they go down and they come up again and they go down again. Like that's just what happens.
Yeah.
So you have to be aware of that, but you have to kind of have a target of, okay, cool. Well, if we did 500, like I don't really want to go back and only play another 500. Like let's push it a little bit more, you know, the 750. Oh, we nailed 750, 750 people came. Let's go do 1,000, you know? I think it's just like the natural progression.
Yeah.
But I mean, once again, it does come down to like what you want out of it, dude. If you're quite happy playing a 350 cap room forever or, you know, for the extended period of time, then just do it, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, like if that's what you want, that's what you want. If you really want to like take it further and then push for something more.
Yeah, totally. Highs and lows are what you were just mentioning. How many lows have you been through where you're like, things need to change because they're not where they should be at?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I think around 2012, 2013, I lost a lot of direction.
Yeah.
What
was the reasoning behind losing?
I think it was, so dude, I was based in South Africa.
Yeah.
And locally the scene took like a really big dip, you know, it was almost like no one really knew what they wanted. The parties were like really empty. And I think when you're playing like empty parties and the music's not connecting, you like start overthinking, like trying so many different things to kind of like find the right direction. And I think over that period, I was putting out like kind of weird music. It just, like again, formulaic, you know, like oh, maybe like if this is working like on Beatport, like let me make a record like that and it will do well, which I think you really shouldn't do. But anyway, I think that's what happened. I lost a little bit of direction as soon as the clubs started pushing other music, right? So there was a, you know, as soon as like maybe a buyer came in, took over a club and pushed a certain kind of music and people started coming through again. That's when I found direction again. So it was interesting. It wasn't like, I didn't really necessarily find it through production. I found it through like the live shows, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Shows how much inspiration can come from
a show,
the performing side of things. But that was probably like the lowest. And then, you know, once I started putting out stuff, like I'm trying to think, what one of the turning points was, I mean, Back to You was like really big in South Africa. And that's, I think like just inspired me a lot and helped me kind of push me into sort of the, you know, the Watermelons and Road Trips and that stuff that like really connected a lot with like the US market. Like when that switch happened, I wasn't really aware of how well the stuff was doing in the States.
Yeah.
Or how much of a following I was building in the States while I wasn't there. Stuff like Road Trips and you know, the Dirty Bird records that I put out earlier on, and the same Bristol stuff.
Yeah.
That was just connecting like crazy.
Yeah.
And that was like that was the switching point. And I mean, to be honest, since then it's been feeling pretty good. Like the trajectory has been feeling really good. I mean, COVID was the hiccup. I think that might be a time where things went weird for a little bit. I mean, it didn't necessarily translate to like the live stuff, but you know, creatively, I think it was kind of, like I said, I was making cool music and I'm really happy with what I made in lockdown, dude. Like I play it in my sets now.
Yeah.
And they're some of the highlights, but, I think like personally, we're talking about pressure going back to that. I put a lot of pressure on myself, like at this point now. You know, I feel like the next step has to happen now.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is the pressure, it either makes or breaks you, doesn't it? And I think you also have to take the risk of like just getting on with it, really, because there's nothing you can do once those shows are announced, which they're announced now. It's like ticket sales are on, and we have to sell these shows out, or not even sell these shows out, we have to sell these shows.
They've got
to
do well.
They've got to do well, and like and kind of grow from there.
Yeah.
It's really interesting you were saying what you were saying, where your records were kind of pushing through in the US when, and you didn't even realize. So one thing that I've always said about your career to other people, I don't think I've even said it to you, but I think the fact that you were in South Africa and you couldn't tour in the US, and you were only in the US like a couple times a year, let's just say, like very occasionally, it created like this need for Kyle Watson. And I think that is something that is really important in a career. And I think it's really, like, for me, is like I just toured relentlessly in the States. And I don't think that necessarily helped me at the beginning of my career. At the beginning of my career, yes. But, like, there was a point in my career where I was just, like, almost a circuit DJ, because I was just playing every weekend, everywhere. There was always somewhere to play. And I think being away from the market is, and creating a demand is so important. How have you found that?
Yeah, I 100% agree, dude. 100%. I think it's very easy to like saturate a market by playing too often.
Yeah.
But exactly like I pretty much agree with everything you said, dude. When you're starting out, it's important to get in front of as many people as you can. But then there is a point where you have to, like I said, you have to be aware of it, when you have to think to yourself, okay, let's start being a bit more exclusive, you know, a bit more harder to find. You have to know when to make that change. But I do think for me, 100% worked in my favor, because for, I think, let's say probably like a year and a half before I actually got an agent in the States, maybe a year, I had people messaging me, when are you coming to LA? Come to the States, come to wherever, come to. And like, it took me a long time before I like proactively found an agent and decided like, let's do it. And I think that helped a lot, because that first run that I did in the States, it was, I think we almost sold the whole run out. Like it was great. That's dude. Amazing. I mean, like obviously there were some shitty shows.
Yeah.
I did play some empty shows. But like as a whole, it was like a huge success. And so creating that demand did help. And then that kind of stayed that way for the first, I had to like measure it in O-1s. You get this O-1 visa, this for 3 years. That was my first O-1, you know, I was going way less than other people. I was playing way less. And so the demand was high and did play into my favor. 100%. It is very important to balance that, because, you know, unless you've got like so much music coming out and like everything is a hit and everything is connecting, I think it's important to like have a bit of space between performances and stuff in certain markets. So, like, once again, different, like some markets are different. But in general, some exclusivity is important, as long as you're keeping the music going and it's connecting.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think the music is still the main kind of driver in all of this, although like, unless maybe you're like more of a character and kind of more of a
performer
person online, where like you can sell tickets through your social media where people want to just see you as the character, which there's plenty of those around now, which is a really interesting thing for me.
It changes the dynamics a little bit,
changes massively, and it changes how people, I'm not saying it's wrong, like I really don't give a fuck, like whatever works for everybody, but it's interesting how the industry has changed through that as well, where
I think it was inevitable.
Why was it inevitable?
I mean, people live online now, dude. If you don't know what to do, you go on your phone. What do? You flick through TikTok, flick through Reels, Instagram. So if you're seeing someone posting like funny shit all the time, like you connect with that person.
Yeah, totally.
So I mean, it's there, dude. It's one of the, I think a lot of artists are not like that. So I mean, on my Patreon, right, like I mean, I obviously do sessions with a lot of people, and a lot of people are like, I'm not good at like the social stuff, you know. It feels like such an important part of like the like the arc of your career.
Yeah.
Some people just don't dig it. Like to be honest, dude, like I could be 1,000 times better at it. Like, you know, I don't have like a social media team or anything like that. Yeah. I'm just fucking posting up my own shit, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not like, it's a lot to think about, dude, because you have to like always be aware of like how the algorithm's changing. I mean, like as an artist, I just want to fucking sit in this heat in the fucking studio while my eyebrows melt off and make beats, bro.
Yeah.
Like I don't necessarily want to have to know like when Instagram is changing their algorithm and like, oh, I should be doing this now or that now. Like I don't, like as an artist, you just want to fucking, you know, just want to craft your art. So it's kind of frustrating. A lot of artists don't really want that side of things or want to worry about that side of things, but it is inevitable, dude. It's a part of how you build your brand now. I don't think it's ever going to be different, dude. Like people have moved online. I don't see it going backwards.
Yeah. I feel like it's constantly evolving. And what I personally, I hope that it turns into is more of like community-based things where it's a smaller amount of number of people, but it's way more like direct.
Yeah.
So like, let's say instead of having 100,000 followers, you have 10,000 followers, but all of those 10,000 people are like engaged.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that I struggle with the most is like, you never know if something's going to do well. You never know if someone's going to see it. Like how many times have you played a show in a city and then somebody messaged you like literally the week after going, when are you going to come to this city?
All the time. It happens often, dude.
And it's like, I just played there and it's been all over my socials.
Yeah.
So it's either that person's not engaged with you or that person's just not getting
it's not being delivered
the information. Which we can't all be engaged with everyone at one time, right? We can't, like, I can't expect every single one of my followers to like or comment on my Instagrams or worry about my Twitter or anything like that. There's better things to worry about. But there's also comes a point where it's like, if I'm playing in LA, everybody that follows me in LA should know that I'm playing in LA.
But the companies want you to pay for that, you know.
And even when you pay for it, it doesn't work.
It's terrible, dude. It's terrible. Like if you dive into your insights, you'll see like the accounts reached and everything. It's like, bro, it's like 1%, 5%.
If you're at 5%, you have a very strong social media.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I don't know, man. It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
You know, it should be people are following you or choose to follow you because they're interested.
Yeah.
So they should see your, I mean, I'm just shouting into a vacuum, dude, but I mean, it shouldn't be that way. It should be the people who follow you see your shit.
Yeah. I totally agree.
But unfortunately it isn't. So it's very frustrating. I mean, even if you can create something that's like highly engaging, it just doesn't get to the people.
Mm. Yeah. It's fucking annoying.
It's very frustrating. It's probably the most frustrating part. And as an artist, it's also like a bit of a rabbit hole, because you know, you can follow a bunch of people and see like how much engagement they're getting and how successful their posts are getting and be like, oh dude, I'm failing at this. Yeah. You know, it's like it's a bit of a trap that you have to be careful.
It's so weird, isn't it? Because it's like, I think to be fair, lockdown helped me with that because I unfollowed a lot of people that I just really couldn't care less about. Ideally, I wouldn't follow anyone. I sometimes wake up and be like, I have the urge to unfollow everyone because like for me, I actually like doing social media.
You're good at it, dude.
I enjoy it and I enjoy helping people with it. Like I feel like I could like start a company to help people to do it. If you know what I mean, it could be an interesting concept.
Yeah.
But it's like, for me during lockdown, I actually stopped comparing myself to others on social media.
So
when I'm saying comparing myself, I mean comparing my social media to somebody else's social media. And that really helped me to be like, this post isn't doing well, but I'm going to do another post tomorrow and it might do better, it might do worse, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. People are engaging and I don't give a fuck. And I think that helped me so much. And sometimes I'd lie if I was like that all the time, but sometimes I'm like, oh, damn, that didn't do as well as I thought. Or like if I'm announcing like a tour or something like that, like maybe I'm like, oh, I wish I did a bit better. But I think it's easier for me now mentally to like just accept that it is what it is.
And it always will be, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to. What more can you do? Mm. At the end of the day, like, it goes back to what I said in the beginning. It's the reason why you got into this wasn't because you were good at social media or, you know, you wanted to have like fucking 100,000 followers or something. You didn't really do it for that, right?
No.
You did it because of all the shit that's sitting behind you right now. You did it for like the art. Yeah. You did it for that reason and the fun. So really at the end of the day, that is the most important thing is you need to be feeling fulfilled and that you enjoy what you do.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you're making music and performing and stuff, like you just have to enjoy the fact that that is what you do.
How did you stay like grounded being in, or maybe you didn't, I don't know, but I guess this is what I'm asking you. When you're in South Africa, and living there and you kind of saw all your peers like touring on a regular basis, like how was that?
It was very frustrating. Feel like you're getting left behind because everybody's getting in front of the people again and making the most of all of this initial hype of getting back to partying and stuff. It was very, very frustrating, dude, especially because in South Africa there was like fuck all to do. I mean, like there were some places to play, but I mean nowhere near a proper club. You know, the club shows were few and far between, you know. So it's not even like I was getting local. I mean, I wasn't even playing local shows that were making me feel fulfilled. So it was very frustrating, dude. But I mean, we just, you know, my agent and I, we worked on what was possible, you know. We decided, okay, well, we can get back to it at this date, and so just work towards it, dude. I just kind of kept the music flowing and kept writing and stuff. And I mean, really, what else could I do? There was no real other choice. I couldn't get to the States. I couldn't get anywhere else. So.
I don't mean just during COVID, though. I mean just generally, because even when you were in South Africa before COVID, like you were touring, but there's people, you didn't tour as much as everybody. And because of the travel, if you know what I mean, and because of all of that,
I didn't really mind, dude.
Yeah,
I mean, I was still playing, like I was touring the States like 2 weeks at a time, roughly. I mean, dude, it was different every year, but it was like 2 weeks at a time, once every 3 months or something like that. I mean, you know, roughly, give or take extra weekend or two here and there. But in between that, in South Africa, before COVID, I was playing pretty good shows. Like there was a pretty healthy scene. Music was connecting nicely with people. Like I had like quite good success on like the local radio stations and stuff there. So the shows were cool, dude. I was feeling quite fulfilled from playing local stuff.
I remember when I came to play Truth and with you, and you're literally like the king of of Joburg.
you fucking killed that set, dude. I was so surprised because like the market there wasn't like, I didn't think it would, honestly, I didn't think your music would be received as well as it was. Like, dude, fun. You killed it there. It was fucking awesome. I was so happy.
But everyone would, like, literally chant your name.
Nah, that's the thing in South Africa, dude.
I love it. It's so nice to see, because you don't really... Like, I'd never seen you in your hometown, and I did, and it's super special. You come to my hometown here, I can't even get a show in the UK, so you're good.
Don't even get me started, dude. Don't even get me started. On that,
Detroit's more of a home for me in music wise than Bristol is.
Exactly. Look, I think for me, South Africa will always be home from a music point of view. US will always be somewhere that I tour. I've never lived in the US, so I don't think it can feel necessarily like that, like your home.
No,
from that same sense.
Yeah,
you know, But like, I definitely feel like I've grown the most in the US.
100%.
Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, it's not even a question.
What do you think that is? Why?
I don't know, dude. I don't know what it is about the US. It just feels like, I mean, there's a lot of people. There's a lot of markets.
Yeah.
But I think there's like a, there's also a lot of passion behind the way people go out to these events. Like there's a whole, I don't know, man. It's like a whole proper culture around it. Whereas in South Africa, it's, I mean, there's not really a culture behind this.
Yeah.
People go out to have fun, you know, like, whereas in America, it feels like so, I mean, dude, if you just think about like the way people dress up to go to the festivals and, you know, like the whole thing of pre-partying and after parties and stuff like that, like it's so ingrained in the culture there. I think that maybe that's why.
Yeah. It's interesting though, because like when you talk about the culture, I feel like it left America for a long time.
Maybe. I don't have enough context because I've only been there since 2018.
No, but I think that's when it started to come back in America, really? When it started to build back, because I think it was so ingrained into European and British culture, kind of the whole party thing and clubs and like, look at how many, how small the UK is and look at how many like iconic venues there are, or like new venues popping up, huge parties, like just like Warehouse Project alone, like that's an iconic party every single fucking year.
Yeah, and, no, there are amazing venues here, dude.
Yeah, like Printworks, and where did we go?
Tobacco Dock.
Yeah. Like that was an insane venue.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Like, and realistically, you're not really getting those venues in the US.
Not like that, no. Dude. Not like that.
It would be amazing if there was.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the venues are somewhat different. Like in the UK, it feels like there's more of like character and history around venues. Whereas in the US, maybe, and I'm not saying this is the general rule because obviously there's like crazy venues in the US, but maybe in general, they're just like vessels for events.
Yeah, I've seen a few pop up recently.
Dude, I've played some crazy, dude, like the church in Denver.
Yeah.
That was mental,
it's
dude. Fun.
It's cool.
Yeah. That's just one that popped to mind.
I think it's called the Knockdown Center in New York that I've been seeing videos this summer. Cool. And it's like they've got like a courtyard and it's like it looks dope. And there's a place in San Fran that I don't know where it is, but I've seen videos of it and I'm like, wow, this looks amazing. It's like an outside kind of thing.
I love venues with character.
Yeah, I think also like, I think the one thing we're lucky in Europe is that we're just much older than the States, right? So it's like there's much more, I don't mean this in a horrible way, but like there's much more history in Europe and in the UK. So you have older, like my parents' house is older than America. It's just, you just don't get that, if you know what I mean. It's definitely different. Boxer Cats. Can we talk about it for a little bit?
Yeah, dude. Let's go.
Why did you... First of all, I like always forget that this is your record label. And I think I always tell you that I always forget that it's your record label because it's...
Yeah.
I think because I just see Wongo talking about it and he's like super loud about it. So I just I just always think Wongo is Wongo's. How did that come about and why?
So, I mean... Dude, I don't even remember why it came about, but somehow a conversation started between, you know, a whole bunch of us, me, Wongo, Tom, Jaxie, Mark Spence. I don't know. It was a Facebook message conversation. I don't know who started the idea, but someone was like, let's just start a record label. And in the beginning, it was like, it was a label, but it was a free label. All the releases were going out for free. That was like the main idea. Like we just basically... There was so much music that we all liked because we all kind of came from that fidget house era.
Blockhouse
back in the 2000 Blockhouse, like 2007, 8, 9, 10. And there was so many aspects of that music that we liked. It wasn't commercially coming out. It was very hard to find. And we were like, there's stuff out there that we want to put out. Or like an evolution of that sound.
Yeah.
let's just start a label to get that stuff out. And that's like, that's where it started. And it was free. It was like, let's just put the stuff out. We don't really all have that much time to put into it. So let's just kind of like see what happens.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, dude. It's just like, it grew from there into a label that we, into a brand that we actually started selling like merch and shit like that. And then we were like, well, this has grown so much from where it started. Let's get up in Beeport. Let's start getting the stuff for sale, you know, putting stuff up for sale. And, yeah, it's just crazy how it grew, dude, because now I like go to shows and people will be wearing like Boxer Cats t-shirts or Boxer Cats hats. Yeah, it's wild, dude. I think it's so awesome. And it's just become like a home for that sort of, it's a very eclectic sound, dude.
Yeah.
You know, like we could put out like a very melodic, weird record, but then we can put out like a techno record afterwards.
Yeah.
It's just like really encompasses the weirder, like boomier kind of side of house.
Yeah.
Not like booty stuff, but like, you know, bass heavy.
Yeah.
Bass driven stuff.
Yeah,
which was a focus in all of our music for the longest time.
Yeah, and I didn't know all of those people were involved. Who looks after it now? Is
Wongo drives. Jeff Dublow was the name I forgot. He's also one of the main guys. Wongo does a lot of the main sort of like. Bulk of the stuff
we have
hired people. Wongo's wife also gets involved. Tash does graphic design, so like it's kept all very like, you know, in-house, as in-house as we can, which is cool, dude. It's like it's very like sort of family based in that sense.
No, I like that. Have you ever thought about doing a Boxer Cats tour?
Yeah, dude. Wongo and I have spoken about it a few times. It's got to be right though, dude.
Yeah.
It's got to tick a lot of the boxes, and it's been a little bit tricky to line up, just for various reasons. But like also, it has to be planned pretty far in advance if you think about it, because it has to work with multiple artists. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, there can't be any clashes, the radius stuff, and what we were talking about earlier about saturating markets and stuff. You have to make sure that you're not doing any of that stuff. So it's a bit more tricky to do it like that. But if you plan it far in advance, it could definitely work. So yeah, we have been talking about it. It's just a case of actually making it happen.
You could do some like cool like day party shit in the summer, like something that's like kind of takes it away from like interrupting your shows and Wongo shows and anybody else's shows. You can do like special, like maybe like you do almost like what Dirty Bird, kind of how they started the Dirty Bird barbecue. Yeah. Like it was like you do two shows a year and like everyone just knows that it happens on the same day or in the same month and it doesn't really affect anything else.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, we could 100% do something like that. I think we've built up like quite a nice, strong following, you know, and people are really into the whole vibe of the label. So it's definitely an opportunity.
It's really interesting that you're all from different countries as well.
Yeah.
And like...
So when it started, it was South Africa, UK, Netherlands.
Australia.
Yeah.
And now it's Australia, UK.
Well, I mean, some of the original founders are more involved than others, but it'll be mainly like UK and Australia. So I'm mainly Australia.
Yeah.
But it is the most successful in the US, just connected with people in the US the most.
The US, man, just amazes me.
It is, dude. It's an awesome spot to play.
Yeah, we're lucky. Do you find it hard to play in other places because of that, though?
So, dude, I honestly, the main places that I play are North America, South America, and occasionally Australia, and then obviously South Africa. Mm. I haven't ever really toured in Europe, but it depends, dude. I mean, really, it depends on the show. So I went to South America about a month and a half ago, maybe.
Yeah.
Just for a weekend. And I played like very different shows, right? Mm. Within that weekend, right? I played an insane show at a club called AME. I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's AME Club in just outside of, I want to say it's just outside of Sao Paulo, but I'm not 100% sure where it was. But it was fucking crazy, dude. It was like America level on steroids. But then the night before, I had played like another venue, which was totally the opposite, dude. It was more like a bar.
Yeah.
And then the last venue was like a 15,000 people festival. Wow. So it really depends, dude. Like, I think it's just, you have to be aware that like the markets are different, dude. So your expectations should just be kind of like managed in that sense.
Mm. Yeah. I think for me, like at this moment in time, touring a little bit more in Europe, it's like, I don't go in with any expectations at it, and I enjoy it so much. Yeah. Just like playing.
Just enjoy the moment, really. Yeah,
it's like, I know none of these people know who I am, but that's the fun of it, because I can just play what I want and just maybe win some people over. Maybe they find out my name. Like on the weekend just gone, I played in Madrid. Insane club, a place called Fabric, and they changed all the set times around because one of the DJs was super sick, so I couldn't make it, so I was playing at a different time, and I got tagged in posts of a different DJ of my original time because they thought it was me playing because of the times, and I'm like, it wasn't me playing. But this is the thing I love about it, because they actually don't know who I am, and it's like, really, there's zero, for me, there's zero pressure. Yeah. Like, there's zero pressure about selling tickets. There's zero pressure about, like, pleasing fans with playing certain records. Like, it's literally, I'm going in and I've got to play the best set of my life to win some of these people over. So they try and find out who I am. And I love that.
Well, I mean, that goes back to probably one of the reasons why you got into it, was just to have fun in that moment, dude, and enjoy that part of the art. So it's cool because, like you said, it takes the pressure away and you can actually just enjoy the moment.
It's special, man. Special.
That's awesome.
Your career just amazes me as well, because I feel like you do everything very differently to most people. And I really like this. It's really interesting to me. I want to talk about management, because I don't think you've ever had a manager, a specific manager.
No.
Which I really respect.
The minority.
Yeah, I really like this. What was the reasoning behind this? Because you could go get a manager tomorrow if you wanted.
Yeah, I could. I could get a manager. And I have been... You know, I have had discussions with management, people who have been interested in stuff, as well as with my booking agents. It's just a decision that I made, dude. I mean, I've been doing this long enough, it feels, to kind of like know what I want.
Yeah.
I think it started because, you know, I didn't want to travel all the time. Like, I didn't want to live on the road. And I know that, like, you know, a lot of managers want you to be working, right? And I don't want someone giving me all these opportunities and putting them to me and me going like, no, not really, because I don't want to travel that much. And, you know, life, like I have my priorities. I know what I want, you know, with regards to my priorities. And often with management, that doesn't necessarily line up that well.
Yeah.
Right. Cause they just like, they see like a cash cow and they want to milk it. But also, like, I just like the freedom of being able to kind of like make my own decisions. I think there are obviously pros and cons to it, 100%. Like, I don't necessarily have the same, I can't make use of someone's connections as much, right? Because like management, obviously they built like entire career around knowing people and building a network and stuff. So, but really, so have I.
Yeah.
You think about it, you know, I've built those connections personally as opposed to through a manager.
I totally agree. And I think to a certain extent, like a manager, there's a huge importance to managers to a certain extent, but especially at the beginning of your career, like you don't need a manager at all. Like,
I don't think so.
Like even for me, like let's say for instance, with me and Ryan, like Ryan, when it comes to the music side of things, Ryan has really nothing to do with signing my records or anything like that. It's literally, that's all me. That's all connections through myself. And I think if you're taking on a manager to get your record signed, I don't think you should ever do that personally. I think it's this a personal relationship between you and the label owner. Maybe unless you're doing a major deal. I don't know. Do you enjoy... Do you enjoy not having a manager? I guess you don't know anything different.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what I do enjoy. I enjoy the freedom of, you know, making my own choices.
Yeah.
And not having the pressure of someone breathing down your neck, making you... I mean, I'm not saying the managers do this, but, you know, you inherently, even if it's like, you know, unconscious or subconsciously, feeling an extra level of pressure because... Yeah. This pressure is put on by the fact that you have a manager and now there's someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I like having the freedom of making those decisions myself.
No, I like that. I think for me, I've always had managers.
I mean, dude, I see like artists who are just starting out who have managers.
Yeah,
and I mean, it's up to you, dude. Obviously, there's the if you're willing to take the, I mean it's a personal choice, but it's also like a balancing act, right? Like if you want to take the financial knock, because that manager can add value,
yeah,
and that's the way that you want to run it, and maybe like you're just not that good at organizing shit, and you can't wake up in time, and you miss your flights and stuff, you know, like maybe that's the case, and you need a manager to keep you in check. Like 100%, it's different for everyone. For me, it just didn't feel like I needed that. Like I'm quite a responsible person and I'm quite good with like time management. I mean, apart from the fact that I fucking procrastinate like a bitch. If they're saying it needs to get done, like I'll get it done. Whether it's done like 2 weeks before or at the 11th hour, like it's going to get done.
Yeah.
So I'm quite responsible in that sense. And I think that's why. Also, I don't like party hard or anything like that. I don't drink a lot.
Yeah.
Either. So yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think for me, it's like I've always been super hands-on in the kind of management relationship. So for me, over the years of having managers, I've always looked at them as kind of like they should be doing this for me and they should be doing that for me. However, until I started working with Ryan, like it's completely changed my perspective on what a manager should be doing and shouldn't be doing and what an artist should be doing. And realistically, like it's just to add to the team. It's not like shoulds or shouldn'ts. Yes, they technically work for you because you pay them, right? But realistically, it's like they're just another part of me. Two of us can do a job rather than one of us doing a job. That's kind of how I look at it now.
That's the pro, I think, of finding the right manager and having like the right person with you. It just adds to the whole, it adds to you as an artist, really.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the biggest advantages also is taking a bit of time out of like the admin stuff that I was talking about earlier, you know. You don't have to necessarily worry about that so much that you're able to put more time into the music and stuff like that, which that is pretty fucking important. But once again, if you're good at, you know, time management and you're clever about that stuff, you can get the same results.
Yeah.
But, 100% agree with you. Like if you find the right person who feels like you know, two puzzle pieces that fit together, then it works, dude.
No, 100%. I agree, man.
Yeah.
What have you got coming up music-wise?
So music's in a weird place at the moment. I have a lot of stuff. Obviously, I've been working on the album that I spoke about earlier. That's more of like a body of work. So I'm kind of like test driving those tracks out, like in different stages of completion and kind of tweaking them and everything. But with the other stuff, we're in a bit of a weird time, dude, to be honest. We're re-recording a vocal. We're in some clearance issues at the moment, dude, to be honest. So
the worst.
I hate it, dude.
Samples.
I know you have some. Yeah, you've been through some of those. But we I can't really say the labels, but we were re-recording a vocal for a track which I've been playing out for a while. It's working like really fucking well, but we have to sort out the sample.
Someone actually hit me up for that record the other day. A DJ.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, a DJ was like, I've been hearing this record everywhere.
Oh yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. There's another one though. Not the one you're thinking of. There's another one which is like original. But anyway, we're re-recording for that. There's that. I'm shopping something else out now, which I was just working on like before we jumped on the call. Mm. So at the moment, there's like a lot of music that I've been playing and that's finished. But we're just trying to nail down the release dates and stuff. So it's weird, dude. It feels like very much in limbo at the moment, which is kind of like a bit frustrating.
Yeah,
but you just need it feels one, like very close.
You almost just need one to be locked in, and then everything else kind of falls.
We're really close, dude. I'm getting a vocal today, so hopefully one.
Oh, sick!
Hopefully one we can nail now. It's weird. It's because I've usually worked like 6 months in advance, 8 months in advance. So it's kind of weird to be in a position where it's not as organized. But yeah, we'll be nailing stuff down shortly.
Yeah, for me it's kind of stressful when the things aren't locked in.
And it is.
How do you find that when you're like promoting music, when it's like more last minute? Do you not feel as confident in the release?
Dude, I've had tracks, not really. I've learned over the course of the years to not have that many that like expectations, because I've worked 4 weeks like promoting a record and it's kind of like not really done that well, but then I've had, and some have done really well, and then I've had records where I'm like, oh, I finished this as a B-side and it gets signed and it like fucking does 12 million plays. So I've really learned not to try and expect too much. I think like having the expectations, you're almost setting yourself up for disappointment. Like
I wish I could do that.
It's hard, but I mean, like, I'll just put the record out, and if it does well, amazing. If it doesn't do well, fucking whatever. Like, there's another record coming out in a couple of weeks or a month or 2 months that might do better. As long as you're proud of like what the product, the end product is of each record. Yeah.
What is now in Kyle Watson's head? What is a record doing well?
Great reactions at shows.
Mm.
Even if people don't know it, I think like that's just a great indication of a good record. And then obviously just, you know, lots of streams.
Yeah.
Beatport's important. I place kind of a little bit less focus on it nowadays, but it is important to know as an indicator of like how many people are playing it.
Mm.
You know, you don't get an indication of how many people are playing the record just from like Spotify stats or whatever.
Mm.
But on Beatport you do, because people have had to buy that DJ for a new record to play it. So I think like at the end of the day, that is always going to be like a strong indicator of how well it's doing within like the industry.
Yeah.
But I want to see it do well on Beatport, but I also want to see it doing well and connecting with like people on streaming sites.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's weird, isn't it? Do you look at radio at all? Does radio ever even get
radio
involved?
Used to be a focus for me in South Africa, but it was obviously like very focused to just that market. I haven't placed as much focus on it here in the UK, but I really should. Like, we've been speaking about it a little bit more and trying to connect with some of the DJs and stuff here. But yeah, I don't place as much focus on it as I probably should. The US, I mean, obviously like having it played in like the syndicated shows and stuff, that's quite important, because I mean, like obviously if Diplo picks up something to play in his Revolution or Heldens, you know, those guys, obviously that's great, because I mean, then it puts a record out in front of more people.
Yeah, radio in the US is weird, isn't it? They don't really have a radio in for like electronic music so much.
Not really. I mean, that's why the shows and stuff are important, like the curated shows, the DJs, producer stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
it's weird promoting a record, especially like Do you send your records to your mates? Is there like a group of people that you send your records to? Or is there like a point where like your records just sound so much like you that you're just like, well, no one's going to play this. So
No. So I go through stages, dude. Sometimes I blast to producers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, maybe you'll like this. Sometimes I just don't even get there, bro. I just don't fucking do it. And I just let the record go out. But I do have like a little list of artists to send stuff to. Mm. Unfortunately, I only really send stuff to them like 25% of the time.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it, how we are as artists.
I do send stuff to a very small amount of people.
Yeah.
If I think that it's something that they would play and they're involved in like a target label or whatever, yeah. I will send them like a copy and be like, do you like this? Would you play it? And at the moment, two of the records which you're working at are being played out by big artists a lot. And they get people are videoing them and stuff. Mm. So I don't think you can discount the importance of that.
Yeah, it's so important. So important.
It's important for that. My agent actually said it to me. It's like the buzz, really. It's like it's not the overt stuff. It's like the tracks that people are going like, fuck, I always hear like X or Y or Z playing this record. Like, what the fuck is this? You know, and it starts like working its way through underneath before like coming up to the surface. I think it's important for that, like that buzz.
I agree. They're the best records, if I'm honest with you. Like for me anyway, like they're the records that you play for a year before it comes out and other people are playing it and it's regularly in their sets. Yeah. And then people start asking and asking and asking and then they find out that it's yours and then then it comes
organic.
Out. Yeah, it's super important that. But I also find it doesn't always work like that and it can't always work like that. There's so many, like, I guess for classics, like talking to Chris Lake, the like turn off your lights, turn off the lights record or what, I think that's what it's called. I don't think any DJs were playing that at all. And it's his biggest record. And everyone loves that record when he plays it, if you know what I mean. But are other people playing it?
It's a huge record.
Yeah, but
I used to play it all the time.
Yeah, like, but I remember him talking about it and he was like worried about releasing it because it was like not what you'd expect.
Yeah. That's the intricacies of this business, of this industry, dude. It's like you literally don't know. Like exactly what I was saying earlier about, you know, writing a B-side and... Mm. And then someone signing it and it going like, and it doing really, really well. Like the tracks, literally more often than not, the tracks that really you expect the least out of give the most back.
Yeah.
It's weird, dude, because I don't know if it's like a human nature thing or maybe I'm just not fucking that good at like judging my art or something, but like that it's weird, dude. It seemed like a pattern, at least through my own experience that more often than not, the records which you were like, yeah, this is cool, like we should just put it out or whatever, are the ones that like are the tracks that you play for like 3-4 years in your sets.
Yeah, it's so weird.
Yeah, it's just I'm not sure if that's like maybe just me or other artists, but that's what it's felt like to me.
Yeah, going back to your tour, how is it when you're just playing your own records in a set?
I mean, I really dig it, dude.
Yeah.
I play a set mostly of my own stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, like it's very much a mixture of like my stuff, you know, and of that most, or some that people know, some that are people don't more now that people don't because just of the amount of stuff I have sitting around. Mm. And like Box of Cats promos and Box of Cats pre-release stuff. And then a small amounts of tracks that are out that people might know, that mostly the people might not.
Yeah.
But I really enjoy that playing my own stuff out. I mean, I try and remember that, like, maybe not so much a festival. I mean, obviously a festival is important because you have to play like all your biggest records, but like clubs and stuff, people have bought the tickets because they like your music. So you really want to like, you want to make sure, look, dude, at the end of the day, like a DJ's job is just make sure everyone had a good time. So like a lot of people came out because, oh, they're like New Boy, or they're like Sides, or the Ratchet Express, or My Level, or whatever. So you want to like tick as many of those boxes for people on the night. But at the same time, you obviously also want to introduce them to, you know, what's coming up. So you package it all together into this set, which is cool, because if it's like mostly your stuff, you're able to like, you get that feedback straight away. Like, are people already feeling this? Or are this track's getting a bit old now? Like, maybe I should retire, kind of thing. So I do kind of like that.
I think being able to play your music is, it makes you more unique as a DJ. And although there's so much music out there to find in on Beatport and Bandcamp and all of those other places, but like no one else is playing those records that you've not released. So it's 100%. It's only you, and they can only see you play that record.
There's a 100%. There's a time. There's a time for a set full of music that you've dug way deep to find of others. There's times, there's moments for those sets, but there's also moments for, you know, for you to showcase like what you have spent like a fucking 15 years building up. And that's what My Machines really is. I mean, it's 15 years worth of music and growth and stuff. And what I like about it the most is the fact that the way that I put it together, it doesn't feel necessarily like some of the records are as old as they are. Even though the style has changed and like obviously everything has evolved and the music's gotten like technically much better than what it was 15 years ago, the ideas and stuff still work somehow. Like you can still play like newer stuff and find a way to transition to something that's like much lower energy, but that still sonically fits, you know, and then move up again after that. And I mean, over the years, I've made like a lot of bootlegs and edits and things which just literally never came out, which get great reactions and stuff, and records that I was like not necessarily commissioned for, remixes that I was commissioned for that I turned into something that was my style, but like the label was like, oh, we're not looking for something like this. Well, fuck you, I'm gonna play it out anyway. And like those records have connected with people even though they haven't come out. So it's like an opportunity for people to come and see Kyle Watson, maybe the Kyle Watson that they know, but also a lot that they didn't. Like if people only picked up from like Road Trips On, or even more recently, dude, like something in 2020, if they picked up from there, there's like a whole catalog of stuff from before that they probably will be into.
Yeah.
We just don't know it yet.
Yeah, I love that concept. Because it's almost like a live show, right? Rather than, but you're just DJing.
Yeah, it's DJing, but it's like a, it's not one of those sets. It's different to a normal set. It's not one of those sets where you've built a track, a playlist, and you're vibing out like what to play. Yeah. It's like, it's more curated than that. It's like a sort of a story.
Yeah.
You know, it starts somewhere. It takes you to the end through the ups and downs.
And I think the thing is you know the music better than anybody else. So it's like, it's not like, oh, is this record going to work? Like, it's like, no, I know every second of this record, when this is going to happen and when that's going to happen and when I need to mix out and when I can put this in a set. I really respect it. It's really interesting.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
We've just done an hour and 45 minutes. We should probably wrap this up because we're both going to roast in these rooms. Before we go, how can people get tickets for the tour?
All right. Tickets, kylewatsonmusic.com/events. They're all there. The full flyer is on my Instagram. All the socials, Kyle Watson Music everywhere. Instagram, Twitter, yeah.
Sick. And how can people sign up to your Patreon?
My man. Patreon.com/Kyle Watson Music. There's four tiers, I think. Supporter, awesome, awesomer, double awesomer. Different ranges. didn't spend a lot of time thinking about the names. all the info is on there. Sign up. If there's so much content on there now, it's actually crazy.
Love it, man. I love it. Yeah. Dude, it's been actually really nice to finally do this. We've been talking about this for fucking ages. So, dude, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, man. It's always a blast talking to you.
Likewise,
you're actually quite a nice guy. So yeah.
I try, I guess.
funny thing, dude, just coming back from the US this past weekend, like I forgot my beard trimmer. Tash was like, you're gonna look like wool, dude. I literally shaved this morning. We were joking about it.
You should have kept it on.
I needed to shave, dude. My mustache, I don't know how, like Dom Dollar, I don't know how he does it, dude. That thing is so fucking itchy, man. It just drives me crazy.
Was it getting long
for me, dude? It was like, you know, and it starts getting messy and sticking out like different angles.
Yeah,
like, it was a lot, bro.
Yeah, I need to actually trim this a little bit because it's...
Yeah, you've got to get like the...
It's slowly starting to go into the lips. When I used to curl it, like, yeah, and it was long. Like, I could literally pull it out here. It was long.
Yeah, I was worried people were going to start calling me Dom Wool, dude. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Dude, I love you, man. Say hi to Tash, and I'll catch you soon. Big love.
Will do. Big love, bro. Take it easy.
Peace.
Peace out.
And that is a wrap. We are done. Thank you, Carl, for coming on. Hope you enjoyed it. Please hit subscribe. Please share it with everyone. Thank you so much for listening. It means the world. Till next time.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you are ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.